Hi, everyone. We're back. After a bit of a hiatus, the MVP Mass Violence Podcast is returning for our next season, and we're really excited to be with you and share more interesting topics that cover the world of mass violence and give you some insight into the issues that victims and survivors of mass violence have to deal with. And to do that today, we're going to be focusing on mass violence victims' interaction with the news media. When a mass violence crime occurs, it is without doubt a huge news event, and it's obviously of interest to the community in which the mass violence incident occurs. It's usually of interest to the entire country. And depending on the scope of the crime, sometimes it's even newsworthy across the whole world. The news media play a significant role in educating the public about the details of the crime. If there are any ongoing threats to public safety, the news media can share those. And we also find out from the news where people, including victims and survivors, can go for reliable information and assistance after a mass violence incident. But the intense trauma that victims and survivors endure in the immediate aftermath of a mass violence incident is often made worse by the intense media coverage that follows. And that's an interesting conundrum, and here to help us understand it and help us understand how victims can advocate for themselves and handle these kinds of interactions with news media is our own Associate Academic Program Director, Ann Seymour. Longtime listeners have heard Ann on the podcast before, and will know that she began addressing crime victims and the media issues all the way back in 1985. She's been a national advocate for crime victims and survivors for 40 years now. And today's topic about victims of mass violence and the media has been a huge priority for her over the course of her entire career. And welcome back to the MVP.
Thanks, Dan, and thank you for devoting an MVP episode to one of my favorite issues.
You're very welcome. And I'm just really excited to pick your brain about an issue that you're so passionate about. So 40 years is a long time, and I'm really curious, you know, 40 years ago when you first started out, what drove your interest in issues related to news media coverage of crime and victimization?
Well, like most of my career, my interest was driven by victims and survivors themselves. I had just left my work with the National Office of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and we were getting ready to help start what's now the National Center for Victims of Crime, which is one of our center's partners. I met the wonderful victim advocate, Linda Barker-Lawrence, who worked at Families and Friends of Missing Persons and Homicide Victims in Seattle. Linda was working simultaneous on several cases related to the Green River serial killings and also the victims of serial killer Ted Bundy. She reached out to me because she was horrified about how the news media were covering both cases. I distinctly remember, it's seared on my brain, one newspaper describing one of the Green River killing victims named her and then said her frozen nude body was found adrift in a snowbank. I wondered who she was, why this description was so brutal, and how we could work with the media to increase their sensitivity to how they describe victims and survivors.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It was pretty distressing 40 years ago. Well, our blood boiled as Linda and I reviewed media coverage of serial killer Ted Bundy, who most folks are familiar with.
Yeah.
He was often described as handsome, articulate, a law student, a rape crisis center volunteer.
Yeah, I've always heard him described as charming. Yeah.
Charming, yeah. A charming serial killer. And I think in describing that, it just negates, first of all, not talking about his victims, the people that he harmed and murdered, but also making him out to be, you know, heroic in some way. It was just appalling to both Linda and I. So as we used to do, we got pretty angry and we sat down together and wrote what's now considered a real seminal publication in our field. It was a little brochure and then a handbook just called Victims' Rights in the Media. And it was the first time that news media coverage from a victim and survivor perspective was addressed. And you know, this is back before we had the internet or even faxes. I mean, so we were mailing this little guide out to thousands of people across the country, and it was very well received. And our little brochure and guide led to some really important things, again, almost 40 years ago. There was ongoing work with the Texas Christian University Journalism Department, who held a national conference in 1987 to address the topic of victims in the media. And we ended up expanding our work after the TCU conference into a detailed guide for victim advocates about how to help crime victims and survivors deal with the media. And then I spent a two-year whirlwind tour giving speeches and being on panels at nearly every National Journalism Association conference, which really indicated their interest in this important topic.
That's quite a history. And I did not know, despite having known you for such a long time, that your little newsletter, such as it is, really sort of led to this kind of development within the field of journalism. I mean, as you know, and as really longtime listeners of the podcast will know, the National Mass Violence Center is partners with Columbia University's Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma. We actually had Bruce Shapiro, who is their director, as one of our very first guests on this program, and he talked a lot about that. He talked a lot about the responsibility for journalists to educate themselves and so forth, and that partnership with the Dart Center has led to some pretty impressive and I think valuable products of the National Mass Violence Center, primarily tip sheets that are available on our website, and those are related to everything from the impact of media exposure on crime victims to advice to journalists for how to cover mass violence, and even particularly for journalists, self-care for victims, for journalists who cover mass violence crimes. But I really want to ask you, when you began working with the National Mass Violence Center all the way back in 2017, I remember that you brought a distinct passion to how the news media covered mass violence and what our center should be doing to advocate for appropriate, fair, journalistic, but humane coverage of mass violence crimes. And I'm wondering, like, what are some of the unique aspects of news media coverage that go hand in hand with mass violence, these large-scale traumatic events?
Well, Dan, as you noted in your opening, news media coverage often compounds the trauma that victims and survivors are going through. At the same time that they're experiencing shock and grief and just total distress, they're often being besieged by journalists to speak about how they are feeling in order to give quote-unquote context to the horror and devastating impact of the crime. And I'm glad you mentioned the Dart Center, because I worked with them about 35 years ago on the broader issue, and they have just been my heroes. I remember I was so excited to do a Fred-friendly panel that they hosted specifically on news media coverage of crime and victimization, and it was just amazing. So thank you to Dart. And Dart has been, I think, joining us in recognizing that victim sensitivity is essential for journalists who cover mass violence crime. They need basic knowledge about the impact of trauma. They need to understand that it's okay if a survivor is not able to speak with them, and how to ask questions and conduct interviews that can bring a really rich understanding of what is lost when a loved one is murdered in a mass violence incident, or what has changed in a survivor's life. Mm-hmm. And I'm always reminded of a national news interview with a journalist who was covering the mass shooting at Columbine High School in 1999. and they were trying to interview students as they were fleeing the active shooting site.
Oh my God.
Yeah, some of them covered with blood, all of them, as you can imagine, clearly traumatized. Later that day, the reporter actually said they were something like a therapist getting the kids to talk about what happened. Ugh. And this was in the immediate aftermath while it was still an active shooting site. And again, I could not believe it. And I was traumatized by that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure as an advocate for victims, that really sort of irritated you. And listening with my mental health professional hat on, it also really irritates me. There is a time to address mental health. There is a time for therapy after events like the Columbine shooting. It is not while the victims are fleeing the scene. Maybe that goes without saying here in 2024. But I think your point is that in 1999, that wasn't perhaps common knowledge in the public or the journalistic community.
I don't think it was. And I also think that, you know, at the National Mass Violence Center, we love our lessons learned. And that was a big lesson for all of us. And I just remember talking to so many people who, you know, they also thought, because they were watching it on television, as you said earlier, this is, you know, pretty big national news. And I think everyone was appalled by that. But again, it was just another impetus for really focusing like a laser beam on the specific issue of media coverage of mass violence. And I think, you know, it's also important for media to understand the critical role of victim service professionals who help mass violence survivors. They can help ensure that all media relations are welcomed by the victims, are conducted in a sensitive manner, and also conducted in a way that doesn't re-traumatize the victims. Mm-hmm. We've learned from our work with the DART Center that covering mass violence crimes often results in secondary trauma for journalists, especially if they cover multiple mass shootings or acts of terrorism.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's easy to see how that can happen. And it's sort of my sense that journalists are in some ways or have in some ways been overlooked, kind of like first responders are sometimes overlooked in terms of identifying people who need help and service after a mass violence incident. There's, for obvious reasons, a clear focus on the victims and survivors of the event itself, but we tend to overlook the folks who came to help or came to share the news with the world. And I think that the DART Center does a great job of helping to overcome that sort of blind spot, if you will.
Yeah, they do indeed. And I think it's just really important to recognize that journalism training up until the DART Center didn't involve, you know, you're going to be covering some brutal stuff. And I think now newsrooms and are much more sensitive to that and really using the DART Center resources and some of our resources to help journalists take better care of themselves after they're covering these horrific mass violence events.
Yeah, you mentioned our resources, and of course by our, I know you're referring to the National Mass Violence Center. And on our website, we have 7 tip sheets that are relevant to mass violence victims and their interactions with the news media. And for folks who are unfamiliar with our website, we're actually going to be including links to these tip sheets in our podcast episode notes. So wherever you find this podcast, check out the episode description and look for links to these tip sheets there. And we have 7. I don't know that we have time to talk about all 7, but I'm really curious, as someone who has been trying to facilitate crime victims' interactions with the news media for decades, what are some of your best tips for mass violence survivors?
Well, I'm going to try to be as brief as possible, but it's really important, Dan, that we start with victim autonomy. It's always the survivor's choice whether or not to participate in an interview, whether in the breaking news phase of a mass violence incident or in the long-term aftermath. And in making this decision, it's important that they're aware of the potential consequences of their choice, both negative and positive. And these relate to their personal safety, their privacy and confidentiality, how much they want to put themselves out there. Obviously, we've talked about the potential trauma and stress, the impact on any criminal cases related to the mass violence incident, whether or not there's a gag order where they're not supposed to talk to anyone. And certainly we know through our National Mass Violence Center, a lot of mass violence victims really want to talk to the media to increase awareness about the impact of MVI. And we, you know, value and welcome the power of their personal stories. And, you know, we have, as you mentioned, a number of tip sheets, but one in particular just offers 21 tips. And I'm just going to talk briefly about a couple of these for survivors.
Okay, yeah, 21's a lot. So let's maybe shoot for your top five of those 21. Is that like asking a parent to name her favorite child too much, or?
Yeah, well, I think it is, but I'm going to try to do it for you.
Okay, so. All right.
So we always tell survivors that they can plan for media interviews. I think the most effective interviews are those that survivors carefully consider in advance with attention paid to the key points that they want to make. They can think about and actually outline what they want to say in order of priority. And they can also, you know, have a victim advocate work with them to conduct a mock interview, so they're comfortable kind of with the whole journalism process.
Okay.
We always highly recommend, and I've done this so many times I can't begin to count, that survivors have a victim service professional or support person with them at media interviews. Someone who they know and trust who can help them and provide moral support, but also I think tend to their personal comfort and help them cope with, as you've discussed earlier, Dan, any of the stress reactions that they may be having.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask you a question about that? You mentioned using as a support person a victim service professional, but if folks, you know, who else besides a victim support or a victim service professional, excuse me, would be a good support person? Like, are we talking family members, friends? Are there folks to pick from that you would recommend?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Dan. And it could be a family member, but, you know, their level of stress may also be high. Mm-hmm. It could be a friend or neighbor. It could be someone from their faith institution. It's just someone that is comfortable with them, that they're comfortable with, who also can, you know, talk to the victim about their expectations about the interview and kind of keep an eye on what's going on. It's not to derail the interview in any way. It's just to make sure that it goes as best as possible without re-traumatizing the victim.
Okay, cool.
And just a couple more, again, related to autonomy. Victims can select the date, time, and location for a media interview. And as you know, there are many mass violence victims who just, they don't want to talk to the media. So we also encourage them to select a spokesperson. This, again, can be, you know, a friend, a family member, a member of their faith community, or a victim advocate. I fulfill this role very often. And the other thing I think that's really important, and I know this is your area of expertise, so have at it, Dr. Dan. We tell victims that they can and should exclude young children from interviews. Kids are particularly vulnerable to the traumatic effects of mass violence crimes. They rely on adults for support and decision-making and to protect them from further harm. And I'm pretty sure you'll agree that kids cannot make a responsible choice to be interviewed by the news media. So my hard and fast final recommendation, do not allow kids to be interviewed. And I'd love your thoughts on that, Dan.
Oh, no, I could not agree with you more strongly. You sort of talked about some of your seminal experiences and crystallizing experiences for dealing with the media. One of mine wasn't a mass violence incident, but it was a very nationally prominent crime that took place in the 90s here in South Carolina, where a young mother ended up awfully drowning her children to make herself more available to a boyfriend. And when it became clear that that's what happened, the news media, who had already descended on her small town in South Carolina, just started interviewing people on the street, and they included moms holding their infants and young children, and being interviewed about a mom who murdered her children in front of their own children. And all I could think about was, they're hearing this. Those kids are now going to be asking questions about why a mom would do that. And it was just entirely unnecessary, I think, and inappropriate for the media to do that. And and it also seemed like they were just sort of ambushing people on the street to ask them their questions. It was really just horrifying. And as a child psychologist, I was just sitting there thinking, there are some topics that while they are emotional and immediate, you really do need to be aware that the vast majority of children are not hard of hearing and can, in fact, hear the conversation that you are having in front of them, and it is going to register. And we do need to take steps to limit their access both to the media and to information. But I realized limiting that, that's a parenting conversation that we could have in a different episode.
Yeah, but I Dan, I remember that case, and I appreciate this as another lesson learned about why kids should not even be included in interviews, but be present at interviews. I mean, think about how traumatized those kids were hearing about a mother who drowned her children. I mean, I'm just thinking about it now. I feel very badly for them and very badly for their parents' poor decision-making at that point.
Yes. And it was a very emotional time. And there were obviously layers to that case that we haven't talked about. And there were lots of reasons why the media was so interested in that case. But that's one that really stuck with me about how the media and victims of crime and even in that case they weren't direct victims, they were just sort of community members speaking to the media, that a little bit of sensitivity and foresight would have gone a long way.
Well, and Dan, I just want you to consider that a lot of the mass violence incidents that we respond to are school shootings, unfortunately.
Yes.
This includes elementary, middle schools, high schools. And so just really emphasizing the point about not interviewing kids or adolescents, I think we cannot overstate the importance of that, especially in today's times.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. I think putting that in the context of school shootings is really an extra important consideration. Thanks, Anne, for those top tips for mass violence survivors who make the choice to be interviewed by the news media. And again, just to speak up and advocate for Anne here, she scratched the surface. If you're really interested in more tips for how to interact with the media and more guidance from the National Mass Violence Center about that, I would encourage you to check out our episode notes and visit our website to find all 7 of the tip sheets that we provide on this topic. And I wanted to shift gears for a second and focus on another part of the mass violence media nexus, if you will. And that is the increasingly, I think, controversial topic of naming the perpetrator or, in the early moments, the alleged perpetrator of mass violence crimes in the media, and the tendency, perhaps, of the media and even social media to pay more attention to the perpetrator and speculate about what identities the perpetrator may have and what motives the perpetrator may have, to the exclusion of the horrible things that they did. I'm really curious about your opinion about that.
Dan, I never get tired of talking about whether or not we should be naming the alleged perpetrators of mass violence crimes. And I think, Dan, you remember the mass shooting in Collierville, Tennessee, in September 2021, because mm-hmm. Our center provided support to that community. I remember I was so touched by the press conference where Collierville Police Lieutenant David Townsend held up a piece of paper with the suspect's name and date of birth. Nothing more, did not name the suspect. And then the press event focused on the mass shooting survivors and the impact upon the community, as it should be.
Yeah, I remember that. And I remember thinking at the time how much I liked that. But I also, I remember thinking at the time, wow, I wonder if, and I don't mean this in the sense of like get away with it in terms of a crime or something like that. But I remember thinking, I wonder if like the local media and the national news media are kind of going to let him get away with that. And it certainly seemed like they did. And I think he set the example, right?
He set the example. And for me, he really set a standard. And, you know, it's something that we work with, as you know, our partners with law enforcement, with mayors, with governors. And that's something that, you know, people are talking about. And we are so, I just feel like we're lucky to be part of that conversation. Because as you said, it's so important to focus on the impact of the mass violence incident on victim survivors, first responders, and community members, and not spend a bunch of time talking and, you know, sometimes it just seems it's glorifying the person who committed the awful crime. So, you know, we are another lesson learned that we are sharing widely with our many partners at the National Mass Violence Center.
Yeah. And you know, I think that there's a growing sense amongst media, at least some types of media, that this is the way things should be handled, or maybe not exactly what the Collierville, Tennessee, did, but you know, shifting the focus, and I'm reminded of. I think it was NPR, and it was NPR that came out with a policy and their statement. And I'm going to read the last part of what NPR said, and I wonder if you'd be willing to react to it. I mean, I know you're aware of this, but I'm going to sort of read a chunk of it, not necessarily the whole thing. But they're talking about journalistic ethics and what ethics codes should advise journalists to do or guide journalists to do in situations like horrific mass violence crimes. And I'm gonna quote starting here. Ethics policies produce better journalism when they affirmatively guide journalists on what to do rather than delineate prohibitions on what they shouldn't.
Yes.
NPR's current practice on covering mass shootings can be summed up in this statement. Use the name of the killer sparingly and focus on the victims. In a series of memos, this policy has evolved over the years, starting with the suggestion to minimize the name of the shooter when possible. What do you think of that as a starting point?
I think it's a great starting point and ending point. And one of the reasons that I'm just a huge fan of National Public Radio, their policy and their practice to focus on the victims, you know, are pretty much everything that our center stands for. And I think about...
Did we write that for them, Anne?
I mean... No, we didn't. But I so firmly believe in this. And I think the other important point is that, you know, over the years, I have worked with a lot of news media on developing written policies. And this is one that they could emulate that really focuses on the victims, but also, you know, the immediate press conferences, which we are all grateful to have, can tell us about public safety, community safety, tell us about the number of victims, the extent of injuries, tell us about if there's any threat, ongoing threat to the community. That's all vital information. The name of the perpetrator to me is meaningless. It means absolutely nothing. And it's not something that I think is important for people to know. So mm-hmm. yay, Collierville, Tennessee, yay, NPR. They are really setting, I think, a high bar for news media reporting in the aftermath of mass violence crimes.
Yeah. Isn't there an organization, and I can't, that sort of has developed the Don't Name Them campaign, or there's a website that's sort of trying to raise awareness about this issue as well?
Yes. It's called the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training. There's a name for you.
Yeah.
They actually sponsor, it's called Don't Name Them campaign, that addresses this issue. And I think it's really important that, you know, law enforcement is embracing this concept, Dan, that they are saying there's just not a lot of value in naming the perpetrator.
Yeah. And we'll include a link to the Don't Name Them campaign in our episode notes as well, if folks are curious about them, although I suspect a quick Google search will also lead you to them without too much challenge. And the last thing I wanted to touch base with you real quickly. It's something that we mentioned earlier and wanted to see if you wanted to expand on it anymore. We talked a little bit about our colleagues and friends in the media who spend a significant amount of their professional time covering mass violence events, covering incidents where lots of people are injured, lots of people die, where there is intense panic, intense grief, pain, and trauma in the community afterwards, and the impact that that work can have on journalists from a professional and a mental health perspective. And I wanted to just sort of pick your brain about that, and if you had any ideas about the best ways for news media to respond to those concerns, to plan for those concerns.
I you know, I never get tired of talking about this because, you know, as you said so eloquently earlier, Dan, it's like, you know, it's an area we don't focus enough on. And I think that, you know, leaders of news media organizations, whether it's, you know, editors or, you know, the higher ups in broadcast stations, they need to realize that covering crime and victimization is difficult, but covering mass violence and victimization is just horrific, as you just described. And they need to have policies and protocols in place that recognize, you know, covering these issues. And it's not just, you know, a couple hours, as you know, Dan, mm-hmm. it's days and weeks, and it can be months. And then there's the trial. And usually it's the same person covering this. And I just know how stressful it is for journalists. And over my career, I have, you know, talked to many journalists who have covered these types of crimes. And afterwards, I don't hesitate to pick up the phone and just ask them how they're doing. And as you can imagine, the response is always not very well. I'm very stressed out. I'm not taking care of myself. I'm losing sleep. The same thing that, as you know, victims go through. So I think just giving a name to this, that they, you know, can have post-traumatic stress disorder. They can have higher anxiety and depression when they cover these events. And fortunately, our good friends at the DART Center published, it's called Trauma in Journalism, a Practical Guide, which is a short booklet that gives guidance to journalists, editors, managers, and all media professionals on working with traumatic issues. And they also have created a style guide for trauma-informed journalists. And so, you know, DART has taken, I'm always giving them a shout out, they've taken such a leadership role in recognizing that covering these crimes is extremely difficult. And, you know, you and I look at it from a victim service professional lens, you certainly from a clinical lens. We need to do the same for journalists mm-hmm. and recognize the impact of covering these crimes on them.
I agree completely. I think that increasingly, like you say, DART, and we've got colleagues like Alana Newman, who's a psychologist who works very closely with the DART Center. Folks like that are making this a significant part of their professional life. And I think I welcome that. I think it's really important to increase knowledge and to be aware of how members of the media, in addition to first responders, in addition to victims and survivors of the direct incident.
Yeah, Dan, I feel like our website is a treasure trove of information on this topic, but I do encourage folks to visit the DART Center, also, especially journalists, but also, you know, survivors and victim service professionals, because it's important for us to know how they're learning about covering mass violence crimes. But I also think as, service providers, there's a lot we can do to really provide support to journalists who have to cover these types of crime, because, you know, we know that they are hurting. We know that they have many, many challenges. So I'm so glad we're having this discussion.
Yeah.
Because it's an important one.
Yeah. And thank you for your perspective and your expertise. And I think this has been a great conversation to relaunch the MVP, to sort of get us back on schedule. And I want to thank you for taking the time to chat with us this morning. And thanks everyone for listening to the Mass Violence Podcast, the official podcast of the National Mass Violence Center. We'll be back next month with another episode focusing on National Crime Victims' Rights Week. So make sure to give us a listen. Thank you.